turning astray of the path that was left long ago.
Hey everyone, this is Steve Donahue with another episode of the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. Today's episode is number 91, and what this is going to be is a recording of the message that I delivered to the church in which I pastor, Mount Tabor Baptist Church, this last Sunday, from Exodus chapter 12, dealing with the Passover, and it should be a good message for you, and hopefully you'll be able to build your worldview and your understanding of who God is, and what we can do about that. But before we take a look into that, I want to direct your attention to a couple of announcements. First of all, make sure that you are a registered user of the website. This enables you to access the pages where you can give feedback, and I would encourage you to provide feedback as much as possible. That helps me to know areas where I can improve and what can be done better, that kind of thing. Also, be sure that if you have any questions, that you're sending those to steve@thelegacypodcast.com. Registered users are also able to get notification through email anytime that there is an update to the website. So this saves you time, and there's no charge for that. So that's becoming a registered user. You can do that on the right column. There's also a place you can click on in the show notes. And then third up, make sure that you are following us on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and all the various social media that we are a part of. And that will help get the word out, and friending us there, of course, will help us to be able to have more presence on those social media sites. So I appreciate you doing that. And then finally, visiting our affiliate focuses, for today. First one up is U.S. Legal Forms. The reason why I am associated with them is that I think that's the best place you can go to get major legal documents in place. And, of course, anybody who is listening to this needs to have a will, power of attorney, advanced medical directive. If you do not have those, that's essential part of your legacy file folder and your documents that you need to be able to pass on a legacy from one generation to the next. And so make sure that you have a will, power of attorney, advanced medical directive. The best way to do that is check out U.S. Legal Forms. You can do that both husband and wife, I think, for about $50, and requires a little bit of your time, and you have to get the notarized, that kind of thing, but no better place that I know of than to do that through U.S. Legal Forms, so check that out. Second affiliate focus is Liberty Classroom. Liberty Classroom is a very unique and excellent resource for homeschoolers and for others who are just interested in history and economics and logic, that kind of thing. They've got several classes online, college level, taught by professors that are well-known in the subject matter and are experts in it and also appreciate the subject matter of which they are teaching. And they've got a Western Civilization course, two courses in that. They've got two courses in American history. They've got a course in Austrian economics, and now they have a course in logics up with more to come. And it's just a great resource, all of that for less than $100. And I don't know where you can get any kind of curriculum for that. Of course, my son is currently going through that with me in the history courses, and it's just a great resource. So check out Liberty Classroom. And then finally, if you like the show, I encourage you to become a Legacy Partner. Our Legacy Partner program is $30 a year. With that, you have access to our exclusive members-only page that you can download some material there. There's an e-book on money. There's also some charts and graphs and documents for farming and gardening. There's also some discounts to a seed company and some other discounts on there as well. So if you are so inclined, I would encourage you to do that. The most important thing from my standpoint is that it helps support the show at less than 25 cents an episode, so $30 a year, and I would appreciate that. That takes care of the introductory material, so let's go ahead and listen to the message that I preach at Mount Tabor Baptist Church from Exodus chapter 12. And we're able to rescue some of those who were coming down. And there's something about watching or being aware of heroic rescues that kind of brings out the best in you. Well, there is probably no greater picture of a heroic rescue than we find in chapter 12. We've talked so far about the 10 plagues and how the Lord had brought these 9 different plagues upon the people of Israel, and how He had used these as a way to signify that He is God and He is the one who is deserving of glory, and that His people Israel are going to be brought out with His mighty hand. And He forewarns Pharaoh about the 10th plague that's about to happen, and that is that the firstborn child is going to be killed. And He prepares Israel for that. And then we get to chapter 12. And chapter 12 is an account of the Passover and the events surrounding the Passover. And in verses 1 through 28, what we find is that the Passover is commanded. And here we see that he tells the children of Israel, or he tells Moses, and the Moses goes and tells the elders of Israel, and they, of course, then tell it to their families and to their descendants, what's going to take place and how they are to take this lamb and the sacrifice and all those kinds of things. And then verses 29 and 30, we actually see the Passover completed, where the angel of the Lord, the destruction angel, comes by and passes over the houses that have the blood around the doorposts. And then in verses 31 through 42, we see that the Passover is commemorated. That is, he instructs the children of Israel. He says, this is supposed to be a yearly feast for you. This is a yearly celebration, a yearly memorial, so that you might always have this before your mind as God's great deliverance. And then in verses 43 through 51, we see this Passover commemorated. Or I'm sorry, verse 40, 31 through 42, we see it consummated with the deliverance of children out of Egypt. And then 43 through 51, the Passover commemorated. And so this Passover was a great act of redemption, demonstrating for us truths about the way in which God not only delivers his people then, but the way that he continues to exercise his act of deliverance in the lives of his people today. And so what are those truths? Well, the first one is this. The Passover pictures for us God's sacrificial method of redemption. His sacrificial method of redemption. We've talked earlier about the idea of rescue. And rescue and redemption are similarly related. The idea of rescue is delivering somebody out of danger. And the idea of redemption is taking somebody who is in trouble, somebody who is in debt, somebody who is in need of something, and redeeming them out of that situation. And so they are similarly related. And so when we talk about, in a theological sense, when we talk about being redeemed or being rescued, it's very synonymous with being saved or being delivered. And so the idea of God's redemption is full here. And the first thing that we find is that the Passover pictures God's sacrificial method of redemption. Look with me in verses 3 through 7. He tells Moses, he says, speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb, according to the house of his father, a lamb for his household. And if the household is too small for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to him take it according to the number of the persons, according to each man's need. You shall make your count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, male for the first year. You shall take it for the sheep or from the goats. And then he goes on, he talks about how you are to sacrifice this lamb and slaughter it, and then take the blood and put the blood and sprinkle it around the doorposts and upon the lintel of the doorframe, so that as the angel passes by, he sees this blood and he realizes that you are covered by this blood of the lamb. Well, what is that a picture of? It is a picture of the need for a sacrifice in order for there to be redemption. This is a continuous theme throughout the scriptures. Over and over again in the scriptures we see this. Remember Adam and Eve after they had sinned, and God comes to them and tells them of their sin. What do? They put on themselves a cloth of fig leaves. But what does the Lord do? He says, no, that's not good enough. We need the sacrifice of life in order to clothe you. And so he kills an animal and he clothes them in animal skin. That's the first picture we see of this need for a blood sacrifice in order for there to be redemption. And then we see Isaac. Remember the story of Isaac and Abraham? We looked at that, how Abraham takes Isaac up on the mountain and he's going to sacrifice his son. And instead of sacrificing his son, God provides him with a ram in the thicket. He takes the ram in the thicket and he sacrifices the ram instead of his son. And then we see in the temple sacrifices this idea of the sacrifices that are to be made for the people, the sins of the people, and for fellowship offerings and all these other kinds of things. And this blood is supposed to be sprinkled upon the altar. And then in Isaiah chapter 53, it declares that there will be one who is made perfect lamb, who will be led to a slaughter for the redemption of his people. Of course, that is a prophecy of Christ. In the New Testament, of course, we see Jesus fulfills this when John the Baptist sees Jesus coming to be baptized. What does he say? He says, behold, the Lamb of God who will take away the sins of the world.
Hebrews chapter 9, verse 22, it says, "And according to the law, almost all things are purified with blood. And without the shedding of blood, there is no remission." You see, freedom isn't free. Sometimes we think the gospel is free. We say it's a free gift. It's not free. Jesus died. Now, it may be free to us. We don't have to kill ourselves. We don't have to offer ourselves anymore in the sense of having to bring bulls or calves or make atonement. Jesus does that. So from that standpoint, it is free to us. But it's not free entirely. There was a great cost to it. And the picture that we see here is that there was a great cost. There was death involved. There was death of the firstborn sons, the firstborn of all the cattle of Egypt. There was death there. But then there was also death of the lamb, the perfect, blemished, unblemished lamb that was needed to be sacrificed by the Israelites. And although I disagree with much of the foreign policy of our nation, the militarism that takes place, there are men and women all over the globe right now who are fighting in behalf of the freedom of the United States. Freedom isn't free. We think of the Revolutionary War and the people who pledged their life and their fortunes and their sacred honor. Why? So that we might be free. Freedom isn't free. There's a sacrifice involved. And so when we see here the picture of the Passover, we see a picture of the need for a sacrifice in order for there to be redemption. That is God's method. Says in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 7, "In him we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins, according to the riches of his grace." Jesus provides redemption today through the sacrifice of his Son. You know, see, we celebrate the ordinance of communion, or the Lord's Supper. And in just a few weeks, we're going to do that. We do that quarterly here. It's a tradition in our church. And that is a picture of the Passover. In fact, Jesus was celebrating the Passover when he instituted the Lord's Supper. When he says in Matthew chapter 14, verse 22, it says, "And as they were eating, Jesus took bread. He blessed it, broke it, and gave it to them and said, 'Take, eat. This is my body.' Then he took the cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank. And he said to them, 'This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many.'" Now, was that really his body and really his blood? No. It was symbolism for what he was doing in himself and giving his life as a ransom so that we might be able to be redeemed. It says, "Assuredly, I say to you, I will no longer drink of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God." And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. You see, there is a great parallel between the sacrifice of Christ in the Passover. First of all, we see that there was both the lamb and Christ were examined prior to the death. It was required in the Passover that the lamb was to be brought to the people and the lamb was to be examined to make sure that there was actually no blemish in it at all, that it was right age and there was no problems. There was no indication of any taint within it. And we see that for years, people tried to find a claim against Christ. And all they come up with was false accusations. Why? Because he was examined and found without blemish. And then we also see that the Passover lambs were sacrificed at twilight. Now, it became customary as tradition went along that this became 3:00 in the afternoon. And what do we read in the New Testament? It says in Matthew chapter 27, verses 45 and 46. "Now from the 6th hour until the 9th hour." Now what's the 6th hour? They start from 6:00 in the morning. So the 6th hour would be 12 o'clock. "And from the 6th hour until the 9th hour, there was darkness over the land. And about the 9th hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, 'Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani,' that is, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?'" You see, it was at 3:00 in the afternoon, the exact same time that the Jews all over Jerusalem were sacrificing the sacrificial lamb for the Passover, that Jesus himself died on the cross. There's a great parallel there. And then also it says that the Passover lamb was to have its legs or all of its bones unbroken. They were to roast it whole. And what do we find Jesus when he was on the cross? And the soldiers come by, they were going to break his legs so that it would be a more instantaneous death, so that they might get done with all the things that they need to get done with. And they came by Jesus, and his death had already transpired, and so they didn't break his legs. And then also we see the picture in the matzah. The matzah is the bread that they would eat, the unleavened bread. And of course, the unleavened bread, if you go down to the store today and you buy matzah bread, which is Hebrew for unleavened bread, and if you were to buy that, you would know that it has stripes on it and it has holes in it. And what is that picture? Jesus' stripes and the piercing in his side. To the very description of the bread itself, Jesus fulfills the Passover for us and demonstrates to us the sacrifice that is necessary for our redemption. Second thing this pictures for us is that the Passover pictures God's multi-generational perspective towards redemption. Try saying that really fast. God's multi-generational perspective towards redemption. We see this in a number of ways, but first of all, in verses 3 and 4, it says that there is to be this lamb that is to be taken as a family. And the family is to investigate whether or not they have a large enough family to account for one lamb. If not, they're supposed to gather with a couple other smaller families, and then together those two families or three families, they're to take that lamb. And so the Passover is to be designed to be done within the context of a family. And then verse 14, it says that this is to be done throughout your generations. In verse 17, it says that this is to be done throughout your generations. Verse 21, it says, according to your families. In verses 24 through 27, listen to what it says. It says, and you shall observe this thing as an ordinance for you and for your sons forever. You see the multi-generational dimension to this ordinance. Verse 25, and it will come to pass when you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you, just as he promised, that you shall keep this service. And it shall be when your children say to you, what do you mean by this service? Well, that's a legitimate question, right? They're participating in all this Passover. They're eating unleavened bread, and they're roasting this lamb. They're preparing this lamb, and they bring the lamb into the house for 4 days while they examine it and get to know it before they sacrifice it. And so all this is taking place. Well, it's only reasonable that the child would ask in that circumstance, why are we doing all this? And then it says in verse 27, that you shall say, it is the Passover sacrifices of the Lord who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt, when he struck the Egyptians and delivered our household. So the people bowed their heads and worshipped. And so the idea is that there is this to be this teaching ministry that takes place within the context of the home where redemption is taught through the picture of the Passover. And then also in verse 42, it says that this is to be done throughout your generations. You see, God's design for the teaching of redemption is to be in the context of the family. Even today in Passover Seders, if you are Seders, I'm not sure really how it's pronounced among the Jews, but in a Passover service, they will have a portion of that right before it begins where the youngest child who is able to talk will ask the oldest member of the males in the family. So if a grandfather's there or a father's there or whatever it is, that child will come up to the leg of the father or grandfather and he will say, why is this night different than any other night? And that then will open the door for the father or the grandfather, whoever the patriarch is of the family, to explain the relationship between the Passover and the night in which they are participating in the great feast. You see, God's design is for there to be a teaching within the family regarding the Exodus and regarding the Passover and regarding the redemption that he provides. Some of the best way to learn is through symbols and ceremonies, and God is gracious enough to provide those for us here. You know, I remember back when I was in high school, and we had a team on our high school cross-country team and track team. I won't mention whether I was honored or not. You can guess. But they were really good. Okay, we were going to do a 2 mile relay race. So 2 mile relays, each person had to do 800 meters. And our goal was to break the school record. And when we put together our times, we thought, that's a piece of cake. We can do that. I mean, all of our times individually certainly would have been well under the school record. And so we were all geared up for it at one of the track meets. And we get together and we won the race. And I think it was either the second or the third person in the race, missed the pass of the baton, went outside the limits and got disqualified. So the next time we said, maybe we ought to practice this baton. I mean, we're good runners, but there's maybe a little more to a relay race than just being good runners. Maybe we need to actually practice the baton passing. And so we practiced a little bit the next week. In the next race we ran, we broke the school record. And I say all that to say this. Sometimes we think as fathers, or we think as grandfathers, we think as mothers, or whatever it is, that it will just happen naturally that our children learn the faith. That's not true. There has to be a concerted effort to pass the baton from one generation to the next. Now, why is it that when you look into the churches around this community and actually around the nation, that there's a generation missing? And it's a generation from about 20 to about 40. Gone. Where are they? What happened? Why did the baton not get passed from one generation to the next? Well, I think that there was a few things that contributed to that. And one of those was this idea that the families are to be separated when it comes to the church. And so there was this trend within the church where you have children's churches. And so the children get separated out of the worship service and they go to their own little worship service and they celebrate the Lord while they worship in their own little worship service. And they have Sunday schools that break up the classes or break up the kids so that all the kids go to their own individual classes and the parents go to their own individual classes. And anytime there was a church event, there was a segregation of the family. And so fathers and mothers began to look at the situation of the church and they said, well, that's so-and-so's responsibility to teach my kid. That's the Sunday school teacher's job. That's the pastor's job, or that's the youth pastor's job, or the children's minister's job. That's not my job. And so we begin to delegate that away. Wherein in the scriptures what we see the scriptures saying that the context for teaching biblical truth is in the family. And so it's not surprising that here in the scriptures, God says, when you gather as a family and you sacrifice this Passover lamb, the fathers to say to the children, this is the reason why we do this. And so there's instruction involved. If we're going to have a multi-generational perspective towards redemption, then we too need to participate together as families in the memorials and the ceremonies and the religious practices. One of the nice things I like about Mount Tabor is that we have a family Sunday school class where families can come together and learn. Now, do our children learn as much as if they were learning in their own little classroom? Maybe, maybe not. But they're learning and they're watching their parents interact and dialogue, and they're learning how to sit in Sunday school, and they're learning some important things like that. And then in our worship service, we've got kids here. Now, some of you might be thinking to yourself, yeah, but I hear a baby cry and it's interrupting. How much better is it for that baby and those children to be able to learn and to watch their parents worship and to celebrate and participate together as a family unit in worshiping God? See, that's what the scriptures say we need to be. And so I'm encouraged to know that that's the way that this church operates. The third picture that we see here in the Passover is the Passover pictures God's overwhelming power in redemption. God's overwhelming power of redemption. The power whereby God redeems his people in Exodus is overwhelming for all those who are involved. This includes both the Egyptians and the Israelites. This overwhelming power of redemption is pictured in the haste with which the Israelites were brought out of Egypt. Look with me in verse 11. Well, first of all, it talks about in verse 11 the unleavened bread. And why is it that they had to eat unleavened bread? Because the scriptures say that they did not have time enough to let the bread rise. Because they were driven out with such force from Egypt that they didn't allow time for their bread to rise, and so they had to eat this unleavened bread. And so from the Passover after that, the unleavened bread was a sign of their haste with which they were driven out of Egypt. And so over these 9 month periods where God was interacting with the Egyptians and plague after plague after plague, it gets down to the last one where the firstborn of all of Egypt was killed. So Pharaoh has enough. And so what does it say in verse 29? And it came to pass at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captives who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of livestock. And let's skip down to verse 31. Then he called for Moses and Aaron by night. So it's nighttime now. So this is probably just hours after. Remember we said midnight was the time at which the angel of death went through and killed off all the firstborn? And it says it's still night. I guarantee they didn't wait 24 hours. It's probably just hours after they realized the death of their firstborn. They call Moses in. And it says, "Rise, go, get out from here and from my people, both you and your children of Israel, and go serve the Lord as you have said. Also take your flocks and your herds as you have said, and be gone." Can you see the anger? Can you see the haste with which the Pharaoh of Egypt is wanting the Israelites gone? You see, that's the power of God's redemption. And then verse 33, "And the Egyptians urged the people that they might send them out of the land in haste, for they said, 'We shall all be dead.'" They're like, "Look, we can't handle this anymore. Get rid of these Hebrews. Drive them out." For a while there, they were hardened, right? They're like, "No, we can't let them go. Here's our labor force. You know, they're supplying all this income to the Egyptians. They're building these cities for us. You know, we got to keep them here. We got to do everything we can to keep them here. We can't let them fight against us. We got to keep them here." But they've had enough. And now they say, "Be gone. Get out of here." Not only did they get out of here, but they plundered the Egyptians, just as God had foretold would happen. They asked for their neighbors' gold and silver and livestock. And so they take out everything that is of wealth in Egypt and leave behind death, destruction, and poverty. It's the power of God's redemption. The powerful effect of God's redemption is overwhelming today as well. Listen to what it says in Exodus chapter 6, verse 6. It says there, "Therefore, say to the children of Israel, I am the Lord. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will rescue you from the bondage, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm." Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 34, it talks about there also their deliverance out of Egypt. It says, "By a mighty hand and an outstretched arm." Deuteronomy 5, verse 15, it says, "By a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, you have brought out the mighty power, and by your outstretched arm," in Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 29. Deuteronomy 26, verse 8, it says that they were delivered by God out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. And in Acts 13, verse 17, Paul, in preaching about this event to the people, he says, "The God of this people Israel chose our fathers and exalted the people when they had dwelt as strangers in the land of Egypt. And with an uplifted arm, he brought them out." You know, the idea of an arm here is an intriguing idea. God doesn't have arms, right? We know that God is a spirit, and so he doesn't have arms. And so anytime it's talked about his hand or his arm or the face of God or something, it's anthropomorphic language. It's the writer of the Bible using language in our understanding so that we can have some kind of understanding of God, because we can't understand something that's not physical because we live in a physical world. And so when it says his arm is outstretched and his hand is upon somebody or his hand is against somebody, the idea there is that there is a force, that there is a power, that there is an input, that there is an ability that is there that is working in such power. You know, the idea of an arm we have brought into our own culture, into the English language, and even prior to that in the Latin language, with the idea of arms. And we have in our Constitution, in the second of the Bill of Rights, it says that we have a right to bear arms. Well, does that mean we have a right to carry around our arms? No, that's not what it means. It means that we have a right to be able to carry weapons to defend ourselves, right? Well, the same thing is true when it comes to the idea of God. He is defending us. He is fighting for us with his arms. Now, he doesn't need firepower, right? He can speak the word and make it happen. And so in Ephesians chapter 6, when it says that we are to take up our spiritual armor because we are in a battle of spiritual forces, it says that we are to take up spiritual armament. Now, why is it that it says we're not supposed to take up rifles? Well, they didn't have rifles, of course, in the New Testament, so it wouldn't say that. But why does it say we're not supposed to take up physical swords? Because when we employ the spiritual armor, when we employ the spiritual weapon we referred to in Ephesians 6, we employ the armors of God. How much greater is that? Now, we don't need swords when we have the arms of God to fight for us. Same thing was true with Israel. Did Israel need to go up against the Egyptians and say, I've got a sword and I'm leaving, or else? They didn't do that. What'd they do? They just stayed in their home and let God take care of it. And he, with his outstretched arm, did mighty wonders and powers and delivered the people of Israel. That's the kind of power that God has in his redemption. The Passover demonstrates for us, God fights for us in our redemption. And when the Lord fights, guess who wins? Our redemption is sure. The impact of our redemption is powerful. It changes our lives. And then fourthly, the Passover pictures God's limited inclusion in his redemption. His limited inclusion in his redemption. Redemption is always limited, and is limited here in this case in two ways. First, it is limited by those whom God chooses to apply his redemption. Notice in verse 19 what it says. It says, for 7 days no leaven shall be found in your houses, since whoever eats what is leavened, the same person shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he is a stranger or a native of the land. In other words, God has this idea that there is going to be certain groups within the people of Israel, that there is going to be the people of Israel that are delivered out, but with the people of Israel, and in fact it says that there is a mixed multitude that goes out with them. Now, what was this mixed multitude? Well, this was probably a group of Egyptians who had maybe married some of the Israelites, even though God didn't really want that to take place. That probably did take place, And when it came time to choose whether to stay in Egypt or go with the Israelites, some of these Egyptians said, I'm going with them. And then there was probably other Egyptians who maybe had seen some of the wonders that were taking place, who had seen the power of God's hand, had seen the arm of God working against them. And he says, you know what? I'm going with these Israelites and being a part of their community. And so they go and be a part of the community. Maybe it was also some of the other slaves that the Egyptians had. And it says, well, if those slaves are leaving, I'm leaving too. And so they come and be a part of the Egyptians, or become a part of the Israelites in their departure. But then there is also another indication of the narrowness of those who escaped. And we see that in the conditions required for the covenant. Why was it, do you think, that God required the Israelites to take blood and to put it around the doorposts of the house? Was it so that the angel would know which houses had those secured by blood in it? No. God knew that. He didn't need to look at the doorway and see if it had blood on it to be able to see whether or not it had Israelites in it. So why did he do that? He did that so that there might be an exercise of faith among the Israelites, so that when they apply that door, they apply that blood around the door frame, they are in a sense saying, I'm willing to obey you and follow your covenant and be a part of your plans. And it was only those who participated in that part of the covenant that were able to experience the redemption of God. See, there is this idea that's going around in our culture today of pluralism. And this idea of universalism. You know what universalism is? It basically goes like this. God is so loving that he wouldn't send anybody to hell. And so everybody is going to be saved. That's not what the Bible teaches. Over and over again, we see that there is a particular people who will be saved. In this case, it was the Israelites and those who decided to participate with them in the departure. In the New Testament, we see that it was only those who call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. God does not redeem everyone. John chapter 1 verse 12, it says, but as many as received him, to them he gave the right to be called children of God. Romans chapter 10, verse 13, it says, "For whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved." Acts chapter 13, verse 48 says, "Now when the Gentiles heard this, they were glad and glorified the word of the Lord, and as many as had been appointed into eternal life believed." I got a call the other day. Some of you probably received calls like this before too, but you know, I'm working. It's kind of frustrating sometimes when you work and you get a phone call and you can't really see. I've got those headphones on my iPhone, so while I'm working and stuff, I can just push my little button and answer the phone. So I answer the phone, hello, this is me. And then a computer comes on. Hello. You know, about a sales call, right? Hello. You have been identified as a person who might be in a class action lawsuit. You're doing great, you know. If you have taken this kind of pill since this time from this time, then you might be involved in this class action lawsuit. If you want to know further, push for whatever, right? And I'm thinking to myself, I've never taken any. I don't take drugs. I don't take any kind of medicine. So I'm not a part of this, right? So I closed out the thing, right? So I will never be a part of that class action lawsuit because I chose not to be. You know what a class action lawsuit is? Y'all know what it is, right? It's where there is this group of people who have been wronged, and rather than each individual person suing the company that wronged them, they collectively come together and sue as a class, as a group. And then that company or product or whatever it is then gives out benefits based upon that results of the court hearing and what takes place with that. So in order for you to benefit from that, you have to be a part of that class. And you have to participate and willingly participate in that and say, yes, I'm a part of that class. And the same thing is true when it comes to God's redemption. In order for us to be redeemed, we have to say, yes, I am a part of that class. I am a part of the redeemed. And I'm a part of the redeemed because I am believing in the means by which He has made that redemption possible. And that is in Christ. There are three things that I think we need to take away in application regarding this. And the first of this, we must understand our need for redemption. People of Israel had to understand their need for redemption. They couldn't be redeemed without it. They were in slavery. And unless we as people understand our need for redemption, we will never turn to the Lord and be redeemed. Secondly, we must accept the means for our redemption. Jesus identifies Himself as that substitutionary sacrifice that pays the penalty necessary to redeem His people. And we must place our faith in Him. And then thirdly, we must live the life of impact that this redemption brings. We can rest in the fact of the certainty of our redemption that is secured by the outstretched arm of God.
And with that, this has been Steve Donahue with the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. What will you do today to build your legacy?
Time after time is a legacy with nothing to show. Now our country is lost, and it's not without cost, for there's many who struggle every day. And I think that it's time we start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? Just like the plant that withers away, we will leave many seeds behind. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? Thank you. life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? What will you do to change your legacy?